Our doctor is in, and so are the doctors of Capital Health. Welcome to the all-new Health 411. Every Sunday morning at 10, Dr. Jonathan Karp, along with our respected panel of guests from Capital Health, take you on an important medical journey to help you navigate your health and the healthcare system to reach your destination, good health. Health 411 is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.
107.7 The Bronc and 107.7TheBronc.com proudly nominated for National Association of Broadcasters 2019, 2021, 2022, and 2023 Marconi Award for Best College Radio Station, as well as the winner of the 2023 IBS College Media Award for universities under 10,000 students. We are broadcasting from the Bronx All Digital Studios on the campus of Rider University. Welcome to Health 411. I am your host, Professor Jonathan Karp. This Health 411 program is presented by Capital Health. In Health 411, we discuss a variety of issues affecting health and wellness, public health, healthcare policy, and the science of health and healthcare. Our goal, then, is to expand your knowledge and perspective. And we are going to do that today by having a conversation about a technique that's out there that has spurred your interest and you wanted to talk about it. A technique called a deep brain stimulation.
Correct. That is deep correct. Brain stimulation.
Now, what before we talk about the background, what was it that spurred you to want to basically have a conversation with me about deep brain stimulation?
So I saw a video a while back, and it was of this guy. I don't know where he lived, but he had really bad Tourette's. Like, you see, like, Tourette's often, mm-hmm. but, like, this was, he couldn't, like, really function because it was so bad. And so he got these implants in his chest that shocked his brain. And I was like, well, what's that? And so I looked into it, and I was like, oh, deep brain stimulation. Let's talk to Dr. Karp.
Okay. So, yes, I have heard of deep brain stimulation before. Deep brain stimulation is nowhere near the top of treatments for Tourette's.
Right. It's more about if medications don't work.
Yeah. For a lot, but that's how it is for other things. It's been around for a while. My understanding of deep brain stimulation comes from its use in Parkinson's disease. And so why don't we start with that, and we'll sort of describe. You can always ask questions and stuff like that, but we'll sort of talk about what I know, because it's sort of on the list of standard of care things for people who have Parkinson's disease. Not right off the bat, because L-dopa therapy or drug therapy is
levodopa is one of the meds.
Yes, is probably the first line of treatment for somebody with Parkinson's disease. But why don't we take a step back and we'll talk about that.
So let's do it.
And then give people who are listening an idea of why deep brain stimulation might work, because there's some unknowns there, kinds of stuff. So in Parkinson's disease, the most common form of Parkinson's disease is not the genetic, it's not familial Parkinson's disease. It's the sort of idiopathic form of Parkinson's disease that happens to people as they get older.
But there's also a genetic link to it?
Yeah.
Okay, but is that like a different type of Parkinson's?
It's Parkinson's disease, but it's the much more rare form of it.
Gotcha.
The more common form of it is sort of the causes are not necessarily known. But there's an area of the brain, and if I'm just talking what you already know, let me know, called the substantia nigra pars compacta. And the substantia nigra pars compacta is important in this context because it has neurons and it sends its fibers to an area of the brain called the part of the brain called the basal ganglia, and a special part of the basal ganglia called the striatum. And the striatum is made up of the caudate and putamen. That's just what it does. And so the substantia nigra pars compacta sends dopaminergic fibers into there. And this is important for basal ganglia function because that area of the brain, the striatum, the caudate putamen, is the major input area of the basal ganglia. And then the basal ganglia has two routes through it, two different subnuclei. And it's important for cognitive, what the people tend to call cognitively guided movements, and which are things like you think about, like I want to move.
So I move my arm, I move my arm.
I want to move my arm.
I blink.
Yeah.
Okay.
There are also non-cognitively guided movements, which people think are primarily controlled by the cerebellum and stuff like that. But we're not talking about.
So it's more like balance, things like that.
Yeah, balance and coordination, the things you don't have to think about doing. I mean, the substantia nigra is also important for other things too. But there's a direct and indirect circuit through there. But in Parkinson's disease, this area of the brain stops putting dopamine into the striatum. So one treatment for that is to give people dopamine, right? And have that function, sort of these cognitively guided movements, sort of being able to come back. And so what people lose is the ability to walk. People have tremors. People's voice changes. You know, if I said to you, hey, smile, Dan. You know, you can do that because your basal ganglia.
But maybe you'd only have half a smile.
Well,
which is what I tried to show you there off camera. But
it was spooky. It scared me a little bit. But the idea is if you can't give people dopamine directly because dopamine won't get through the blood-brain barrier, but you can give them L-DOPA, this levodopa you mentioned, which gets through the blood-brain barrier, and then the remaining cells in the substantia nigra can convert it into dopamine and deliver it to the basal ganglia.
So it's just a different form of dopamine that gets converted into actual dopamine.
Well, it's a precursor to
it.
Because dopamine is a derivative of tyrosine, and there are all these like metabolic steps. And so the idea is if you restore the ability to put some dopamine in the striatum, the idea that some of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease will be lessened, ameliorated, for at least for a while, for unknown reasons. So people who were initially diagnosed with, there's like this first honeymoon sort of thing that happens. And you can take this drug and you've some of the symptoms go down. However, as the disease progresses, because what happens is some of the downstream things, so from the striatum or the putamen.
So the putamen's part of the basal ganglia.
It is, okay. But there are other parts of the basal ganglia.
Right.
One part of the basal ganglia is sort of called the direct pathway through the basal ganglia. And this, because the striatum projects to an area of the brain called the globus pallidus, the internal segment of the globus pallidus, and the other part of the substantia nigra calls the... So there's two parts to it. The substantia nigra means the black substance. There's the pars compacta and a pars reticulata. And so
part of it.
But anyway, the other part, so the globus pallidus and the other part of the substantia nigra are the striatum connects directly to that. However, there's an indirect pathway through the basal ganglia well where the striatum connects to the external segment of the globus pallidus, then another area called the subthalamic nucleus, and then projects to the globus pallidus and the substantia nigra as part of its output mechanism.
So it's how it leads, where it goes when it exits the basal ganglia.
Yeah. So the bottom line is there are these pathways through the basal ganglia, and so the job of the basal ganglia is essentially just to turn excitatory inputs from the cortex and most of the brain into inhibitory outputs to the brainstem, the spinal cord, the thalamus, and all these other things that are going to control movement, voluntary control of movement. And so what happens in Parkinson's disease is movement is, if you fail to turn these excitatory inputs to into inhibitory outputs, you basically become frozen. Kinds of things.
And sort of, is that also linked with like the tremors?
Yeah, well,
things like that.
Right, that's
all.
It's
all together.
The muscles sort of become frozen. It's sort of the conceptual opposite, and it's debated. The conceptual opposite is Huntington's chorea, Huntington's disease, where people have a autosomal recessive disorder and the striatum starts to die and those people start to move uncontrollably.
Right, because I did read that this deep brain stimulation is for that as well.
Well, it's been tried for
that. Tried for it, yeah.
It's been tried for a lot of things and trying it for, you mentioned Tourette's, you know, those are in like early, you know, clinical trials from what I've been able to tell, Alzheimer's disease, epilepsy, anorexia, a whole bunch of stuff. But it's a sort of an approved treatment for something like Parkinson's disease. It's one of the standard of cares after one's ability to respond to L-DOPA, the precursors to dopamine sort of goes away. So that makes sense?
Yes.
Okay. And you're absolutely right, because the reason I wanted to talk about the anatomy a little bit is because that anatomy is critical for my understanding of where they do deep brain stimulation and sort of what the target areas might be and the potential outcomes for Parkinson's disease and other diseases as well. So I guess what we're going to do is we'll take a pause from our conversation for some underwriting announcements. We'll be right back on Health 411. You are listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com.
Health 411 Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health. If someone you loved was sick, how far would you go to make sure they got the best care? Your mother, your sister, your best friend, your neighbor, your son? How far would you go for doctors who will meet with you longer so they really get to know you and who collaborate across disciplines so that they can devise a plan of care that's uniquely right for you? There's no doctor too far, no care too distant that you wouldn't go there. And for more than 100 years, so has Capital Health. From our hospitals in Trenton and Hopewell to our primary care offices all across Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties to right here at Rider University, Capital Health has the team of doctors, nurses, experts, specialists, and staff that you can count on to care as much about your loved ones as you do. Because you'd go to the ends of the earth if someone you loved was sick. And so do we, Capital Health. There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. Welcome back to Health 411. Dan and I are having a conversation about Parkinson's disease. And in the last segment, Dan sort of castigated me a little bit for talking about neuroanatomy. But I'll just reiterate and say this neuroanatomy is important because deep brain stimulation, which is what he wanted to talk about, is used as one of the standards of care for patients with Parkinson's disease, especially after they've become refractory or stopped responding to L-DOPA therapy. And that anatomy becomes important because even though the substantia nigra feeding into the striatum, the death of those fibers underlies what's known about the anatomy of most Parkinson's disease. When people want to use deep brain stimulation to sort of treat Parkinson's disease, they don't target either the substantia nigra, pars compacta, or the striatum. They actually mostly target another area primarily called the subthalamic nucleus, which is why I mentioned that. Some famous people have had like implants into there. And the reason I mentioned, stop me anytime if I lose you, Dan.
Yes.
And the idea is because one of the things that the basal ganglia, the collection of all those things do, is it turns excitatory inputs to inhibitory outputs. And it sort of does that through these sort of circuits. So in terms of chemistry, you can imagine glutamate sort of coming in. That's an excitatory amino acid neurotransmitter, and sort of GABA coming out through these inner circuits.
Okay.
And so if you lose the ability to do that, you have this tonic, conceptually, this tonic inhibition from the substantia nigra.
Tonic meaning
tonic meaning is always there. And so the failure to reverse that is the idea is that you can stimulate the subthalamic nucleus, you can remove some of that tonic inhibition. That's been the classic view of what deep brain stimulation is.
So it's supposed to relax.
In a sense. You remove so a lot of people who haven't had like any neuroanatomy or something think that like when your prefrontal cortex decides that you're gonna move, right, and sends a signal to your motor cortex, and your motor cortex is gonna send all this downstream stuff and create a movement that you're turning stuff on and you're exciting it.
So it's the opposite. You're turning stuff off.
Yeah. So inhibition of an inhibitor actually leads to excitation.
Makes sense.
Okay, so that's a thing that just happens in neuroscience scientists who study this sort of figure it out. And so what happens in Parkinson's disease, you have tonic inhibition, right, that leads to inability for you to voluntarily generate a movement in Parkinson's disease. And so what people have figured out is if I stimulate some of that, one of the circuits, if I stimulate what's known as the indirect pathway that has the subthalamic nucleus in it. If I stimulate that pathway a region of that pathway, I can remove some of that tonic inhibition, and I can allow cognitively guided movements to at least happen, kind of thing. How is that done? And that's where the deep brain stimulation part comes in, because it's like you said, it is putting an electrode, in a sense,
pretty deep into the brain. Like you see the X-rays, and it's about halfway through the brain.
Depending on what angle you're coming from, right? But the idea is that you put an electrode in there, so you drill a hole, you cut the skin, drill a hole in the scalp, and using computers, MRIs, that sort of thing. You use that for guidance, but you have these devices called stereotaxic devices that you put people's head in. Like halos, sometimes they're called halos.
Yeah, I saw a picture of that. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
And then so what they basically do is with people or animals is they hold the subject's head very, very still. And then people have these brain maps, these three-dimensional, they used to be books, but now they're all computer generated because it's you have up, down, sideways. And so you have these in three-dimensional space, these coordinates, and you can identify brain areas using those coordinates. And nowadays it's not done with like people and like little micrometer knobs, it's computer generated, but you can actually follow, you can put an electrode directly in to, let's say, the subthalamic nucleus, and that electrode would come up through the brain, come out the skull, and then a wire would run underneath the skin down the neck to somewhat, not into the neck, but sort of near the clavicle-ish. I think that's where they put it.
Yeah.
And they put like a little implantable device there.
With a battery.
It's a battery-operated device that can control. They used to do it with voltage, but now they do it with current. My understanding is, as technology has gotten better, they control the current coming through the electrode that will actually stimulate the subthalamic nucleus to relieve some of the tonic inhibition that allow cognitively guided movements to resume.
And so how effective is this in the grand scheme of things?
In the grand scheme of thing, it works pretty well. The side effects are very minimal. I mean, the side effects that my understanding of it is, and maybe your reading is different than the stuff I just sort of know from teaching neurobiology, is the side effects, at least initially, have to do with the surgery. So there's
the results of surgery, infection.
There's side effects of having a chronic indwelling apparatus in you. Batteries have to be replaced.
Do you know how those batteries are replaced? Because they're under the skin.
Yeah.
So that's a good question.
I don't know how. That would be an interesting thing to look up about how do they replace batteries on pacemakers.
They need batteries too, right?
Yeah.
It's not powered by the body at all.
No, we're not in the Matrix.
Not yet.
But hopefully these things last a lot of years. There's also these things have to be adjusted. You can control the amount of.
Yeah, you can do it with a remote. Patients that have an actual remote.
They probably do it with a remote. They measure the different kinds of brain waves that are generated. I don't think it cures all the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. I don't think it changes some of the speech issues. I think there's some of the gait issues might not be helped, but the primary thing is it can relieve some of the things, and it is one of the standards of care. People have also looked at putting other parts of it. And I know people have actually put electrodes, done some deep brain stimulation into the internal segment of the globus pallidus, which was after the subthalamic nucleus is the internal segment of the globus pallidus, which is one of the main output regions of the basal ganglia. But I think that's used mostly, not in Parkinson's disease, I think the data show that's used in dystonia or something like that, other kinds of things that go on. Which is sort of interesting. It's sort of like modern technology. And because you have these electrodes going deep into the brain, it's called, deep brain stimulation. Because you put it deep into the brain and you turn it on and you hope it works. The question then becomes, how does it work?
Right. So this is mainly like so Parkinson's is a dopaminergic illness, right? So
at least initially.
So what about... Like I've seen it be used for addiction and things like that.
Well, there's a lot of things that are being explored, that are being tested in, like, you know, clinical trials, phase one, phase two.
But those mechanisms aren't as well known, I guess.
Well,
because this isn't very well known either. But
It depends what you mean by the word mechanism, right? Because the circuit that I just described to you is sort of the classical way of looking how deep brain stimulation works. That's been around now, like, for 30 years-ish kind of stuff. How is it actually alleviating some of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease? Well, it could be that it's removing that tonic inhibition. However, there's some evidence, my understanding, is there is, because neuroscience is going away from the idea that there are brain centers for different kinds of things. And it's going in the direction of the connectome and is what's responsible for behavior and all the things that make up humanness and other animals, is how these things are connected, circuits of things. And if you, in the brain, things are connected to everything else, direct, like all roads lead to Rome, right? It's like if you pick an area of the brain, anatomically, you could get there pretty much no matter where you started. It might not be the most direct route, but stuff gets
there. There is a connection.
There's a connection there. And so when people who have these implants in, or animals have these implants in, sometimes people are, in science, and I didn't look up the details of this, but I know they've looked at, you know, when the deep brain stimulator is turned on, how does it affect the thalamus? How is it affecting motor cortex? How is it affecting fibers that are running through? Because in the basal ganglia, there's this thing called the internal capsule, and it has a lot of axons running through it. So when you turn on this electrical stimulation, you know, what is the effect? Because it spreads throughout the brain. It's not just localized to a couple cells. So actually what it's doing is still being worked out and still being debated. And we can come back and can talk more about that if you want, Dan, on Health 411 after we do our break for underwriting announcements. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com.
Health 411 Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health. If someone you loved was sick, how far would you go to make sure they got the best care? Your mother, your sister, your best friend, your neighbor, your son? How far would you go for doctors who will meet with you longer so they really get to know you and who collaborate across disciplines so that they can devise a plan of care that's uniquely right for you? There's no doctor too far, no care too distant that you wouldn't go there. And for more than 100 years, so has Capital Health. From our hospitals in Trenton and Hopewell to our primary care offices all across Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties to right here at Rider University, Capital Health has the team of doctors, nurses, experts, specialists, and staff that you can count on to care as much about your loved ones as you do. Because you'd go to the ends of the earth if someone you loved was sick. And so do we, Capital Health. There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advanced Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com. We're recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronx Studios. We are continuing our conversation about deep brain stimulation. And I said deep brain stimulation has become one of the standards of care for people who are having treatment refractive or no longer drug sensitive or drug treating Parkinson's disease. It's also being explored for a lot of other things. It's being explored for Tourette syndrome. It's being explored for depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, tinnitus, some major neuropsychiatric things like schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease, pain, epilepsy. So it's being explored in clinical trials for a lot of different things. But in Parkinson's disease, I think it's the main thing where it's actually sort of used. And we said the deep brain stimulation is put into the subthalamic nucleus, which is part of the circuitry of the basal ganglia of the brain, right? The other part was the globus pallidus, the internal segment. That's when it's not used a little bit for not treating Parkinson's disease so much, but it's used to treat dystonia. Probably not as much, you know, putting it in the globus pallidus kinds of thing. And in the last segment, we were talking about what is this actually doing? Because if you put the electrode in there, you know, theoretically, you're changing, you're activating, you could turn on or turn off these inhibitory circuits, but you're affecting neurons. There's going to be a spread of electrical activity within the tissue, which means you're going to be affecting neurons, you're going to be affecting glial cells.
It would sort of be like maybe regions that you don't want activated.
Well, that's like anything.
Or is the technology good enough to where where it's generally pretty well concentrated.
Well, that's one of the things that the scientists are doing this have to work it out. Because when you turn on this electrical thing, it doesn't target like two cells. You're hitting, you know, hundreds, perhaps thousands of cells. And you're hitting, you know, astrocytes, microglial cells, neurons. All the things that are in there are getting stimulated with that spread of electrical impulses. And so classically, you know, if you put an electrode in, you can, you know, activate neurons. But remember, when you do that along an axon in a living animal or even in a petri dish, and you stimulate that axon, there's a spread of an electrical flow that goes in both directions, both towards the cell body and towards the axon terminals. In a living cell, that doesn't happen. The action potentials would only be generated along an axon. So as soon as you put something in there, you've created an artificial state. Understanding, even though this technique works, figuring out why it works.
That's the hard part.
That is often difficult, right? Because there's side effects to these things.
I think part of the way they can kind of pinpoint exactly the area is that they put them in while you're awake.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a thing that a lot of people don't realize is you can do brain surgery on awake people.
That's normally what they do.
Yeah, it's exactly right? That's how they discovered actually these homunculi, these little people maps that are in people. There's a famous person like Penfield, I think it was like from the 50s.
I think I've read that.
And so he had people with epilepsy and he was doing brain surgery on them. So he opened up their brain and he took like a really a very precise tiny electrode and it sort of stimulated parts of their brain and he would see like what mood. He would talk to them and say, what are you feeling? You know, what part of your body is tingling? And he was able to create. Now we know there are many, many homunculi in the body, but those were discovered.
Is that still a term used, homunculi?
Like, yeah,
in modern neurobiology.
Yeah, I mean that's the word for it. It means like little people.
Right.
So there's a homunculus in motor cortex. There's a homunculus in sensory cortex.
It's lucky that the brain doesn't feel pain, because I feel like that would suck if you could feel it actually shock your brain.
Well,
brain.
Getting in there, you would feel it because there are sensory nerves in your skin and stuff.
Right, but after that,
yeah. If you could remove it, it's interesting, and that's one of the
There's the famous video of the person playing the guitar while they're having their brain operated on, and they stop playing well, and they calm down, and then he starts playing well again, and they choose a different area, whatever it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is there? I have not seen the video, but I can imagine. Yeah, no, you don't want to advertise that can happen, and it'd make a great science fiction movie.
It would.
Electrical control. That's one of the things. You have these external control. If all you are is what your nervous system tells you, if I can control it externally or putting things in there, I can control thoughts and behavior. That's a whole other different discussion. So the idea is that when you turn on this deep brain stimulation, you're affecting the circuit pathway, hopefully that you're affecting, but you're also affecting fibers that are coming through that area because the current's going to spread in tissue. You're affecting backwards generation. And the idea is, are you fixing something that wasn't working? Are you just masking, right? Are you creating neuroplasticity? There's all these sort of things that come out of putting these chronic indwelling electrodes into a person or an animal's brain. It's like, what is the effect of that long term on brain physiology, brain anatomy, and brain function?
And I think it could have implications on parts of the nervous system other than the brain, because think about somebody who has a severed spinal cord. Maybe you could have an electrode on one side, electrode on the other side of where it was severed, and sort of regain some function in your legs, for example.
Yes, conceptually, that would be a great idea.
Yeah.
However, what people have figured out is that if you take those same neurons that are severed, that are not growing, and you put them in like in a petri dish, they'll grow. So the question is, when in vivo, like in that
in vivo, cell, they don't grow.
And then the question becomes why.
Uh-huh.
And people have figured out it's not a property of the central nervous system neurons itself. It's a fact that after an injury, the glial cells around that area secrete growth inhibitory things, and they're scarring.
That's what kind of makes it. You can't return from that.
And that doesn't. That's why it doesn't grow. I can tell you from talking to people who are in this business, there's a lot of interest in finding things to do to central nervous system neurons to get them to not just regrow, but to regrow to the right connections on the other side of the wound in the spinal cord and central nervous system. Whether you're going to use magnetic beads, whether you're going to use chemicals or some other kind of matrix to overcome the growth inhibitory factors, but also get the connections to the right place.
So do you know some of the research on how you can kind of inhibit those inhibitory factors? Because we're talking about the electrical part of it, but this is more like the glial cell now.
Well, right. So So if there's an injury, you activate essentially microglial cells, which are these phagocytic cells. They're sort of like a monocytes that get trapped behind the blood-brain barrier during development. So they have a lot of these properties. They can respond to cytokines. Some people think they can produce cytokines. But there's also scarring that takes place anytime after injury. And those are the kind, you know, and so there's you have all these growth inhibitory things that keep the neurons from happening. So it's not just recreating the electrical circuit, like, you know, splicing a wire together. The physiology is a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah, especially if you figure out what damaged the spinal cord. Sometimes there might be a piece of bone in there, right?
And now you have a whole other thing to worry about.
Yeah, have a whole other thing to worry about to remove the piece of bone. And you know, in an animal, you can like make a nice cut, like with a scalpel. In real life, that doesn't always happen. You know, when people have those kinds of injuries, and it's
that's sort of part of like the field of microsurgery, surgery under a microscope. I think that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
Like, I know it's a vascular surgery thing or a hand surgery.
A lot of that stuff you can't see. It's also a place where robotic surgery could be very, very useful.
It's called the Da Vinci. It's a giant robot that does surgery.
That's one company.
Yeah, that's one of them.
That's one company that does it. I'm confident it's not the only one.
Yeah, I'm sure not.
Yeah. I think that works better for, you know, prostate surgery and things like that than... and trying to spare some of the nerves so you can like remove a prostate and not make, you know, people impotent.
Yeah.
I think it works better for that.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to brain surgery.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my understanding, but you have to correct me on that.
Yeah. When I did the internship, I saw it for gallbladder surgery.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. 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 You have a little more leeway in terms of flexibility.
Right.
Kinds of thing. Yeah, so we do deep brain stimulation. It's not just getting the electrodes in there, getting them in the right place. It's adjusting them, you know.
And it's very personalized.
You know. Yeah, it would have to be. And that has consequences because I think the data would show, if you collected it, that most of these surgeries that are done are probably done in first world nations. You need a big team of people. You need surgery, neurosurgeons. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on.
Not to mention all the post-operative care.
Oh, that's a big part of it. So it's very expensive.
Changing the batteries, however you do that.
Yeah.
Which I should look up. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, cause, right, because it's not going to last forever, you know. And like working out all these details, so even if conceptually something can be done, you have to ask the question, should it be done? And... that was one of the big problems when, you know, the negotiations of the Affordable Care Act is like, you know, at what point should you stop treating? At what point do you not want to treat? There's actually, if I remember correctly now that I say it, there are not every patient with Parkinson's disease is actually a good candidate for deep brain stimulation. I think there's some age-related things that happen in there too, where the older the patients might be better candidates than some of the younger ones. But you're giving me a signal. It's time to break for some underwriting announcements. So we're going to do that. We'll be right back with Health 411. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7 The Bronx.
Health 411 Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health. If someone you loved was sick, how far would you go to make sure they got the best care? Your mother, your sister, your best friend, your neighbor, your son? How far would you go for doctors who will meet with you longer so they really get to know you and who collaborate across disciplines so that they can devise a plan of care that's uniquely right for you? There's no doctor too far, no care too distant that you wouldn't go there. And for more than 100 years, so has Capital Health. From our hospitals in Trenton and Hopewell to our primary care offices all across Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties to right here at Rider University, Capital Health has the team of doctors, nurses, experts, specialists, and staff that you can count on to care as much about your loved ones as you do. Because you'd go to the ends of the earth if someone you loved was sick. And so do we, Capital Health.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. You're listening to Health 411. This is our last segment today, but in the break, Dan, what did you do?
Yeah, I looked up how they change the batteries, and it turns out it's just a surgery, like how you put them in. You general anesthesia, open the person up, take the battery out, put a new one in, close them back up.
So I'm pretty sure these are not like double A or.
Yeah, I don't think so, but I do want to see.
I'm pretty sure that they sounds like they replaced the whole unit.
What I read is that they just changed the battery. I don't think it's the whole unit.
Just so they can change the battery.
Yeah, they can just change the
they
battery.
They can open it up with mm-hmm.
I mean, there might be different types of them that you have to change the whole unit. But for
are you seeing how long a battery typically lasts?
Yeah, I'm going to check that right now. I assume it's years because it's not like you need a giant electrical impulse, is it?
What do you mean?
Well, relatively, it's 3 to 5 years.
Okay.
That's how long it lasts, which I'd assume is, you know, a surgery every 3 to 5 years to change the battery. Might not be that bad.
Right. In an area near your clavicle on one side.
Yeah, because it's just like right subdermal.
That's an interesting thing, too, because remember, you have two sides of your basal ganglia on each hemisphere of your brain. You have two subthalamic nuclei, one on each side.
Okay, right? So to what extent is the brain a mirror image of itself?
It's not a exact mirror image. The surgery is only done on one side. My understanding is they don't have to do both. So you only have one device on one side of your chest, one wire running under your skin.
So what about if like a stroke patient? Could this work on a stroke patient?
Well, this is a very you bring up a
with
really
like
good
with the hemiplegia.
You bring up a really good point. So somebody with Parkinson's disease, a good candidate would be somebody who the you have tonic inhibition using old think of unable to generate a cognitive guided movement, but the circuits are still there. They're just tonically inhibited.
They're just always on, in other words.
Well, tonically inhibited, yes. Yeah, so not active on, but you know, this is the
right. Their inhibitors are inhibited, is what you used earlier.
Yes.
Okay.
And then movement would happen because you inhibit the inhibitors. But if the inhibitors are active, there's inhibition. But the idea is that circuit is there. There's something to work on. One of the problems in some of the disorders that we mentioned in Alzheimer's disease is that in Alzheimer's disease, areas of the brain start to die. It starts with some of the areas. So you have from the basal forebrain, you have areas that project to the hippocampus. And in Parkinson's disease, it's substantia nigra projecting to the striatum, and it puts dopamine there. In Alzheimer's disease, one of the areas that starts to go first is the basal forebrain projects to the hippocampus, and the neurotransmitter that's released is not dopamine, but it's acetylcholine. So what happens is the cells that respond to acetylcholine start to die, right? So, you know, putting an electrical stimulation, it's not going to wake up dead cells. You're not going to fix,
gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Dead men tell no tales. Dead cells don't respond. It doesn't matter what you do to them. And so that's one of the problems in even though I know they're.
So
they're
like in an ischemic stroke, this wouldn't be a good.
It would not be a way to restore neurons that have died. However, if you had a stroke that was localized to somewhere in a circuit that was well studied, you might be able to put conceptually deep brain stimulation in an area sort of distal to where the stroke is, and then restore function if you had a way of like controlling that stimulation.
I see.
So in Parkinson's disease, I think those stimulators are sort of on. You'd like turn it on, you adjust it. You alleviate, like it doesn't make everything go away. Like the speech issues aren't going to go away, but some of the, you know, movement issues are going to go away. I don't think your gait is going to change, but at least you'll be able to move. So it doesn't like remove Parkinson's disease. It just lessens the severity of it. It also doesn't stop the progression of the disease. That's why there, theoretically, you know, adjustments have to be made and, you know, things like that. You have to goose it up. And then, so you might have this initial like second honeymoon when the device starts working, but it's not going to work.
It won't work forever.
It probably won't work.
So I think they have seen that with deep brain stimulation as well in general, that it's not effective for forever.
Well, the idea is, you know, if it's not going to stop the disease process. If you have an underlying brain disease.
This is really about treating the symptoms.
Yeah, right. The disease, if it's chronic and progressive, is still going to happen. I guess conceptually, if it didn't happen, you might say the deep brain stimulation is changing neuroanatomy because of neuroplasticity. It might be creating, you know, if you have, you know, high or low frequency stimulation, you know, if you have something that is, you know, like tonic low stimulation, then you put the electrode in and you create high frequency stuff that overcomes it, you can mask the signal. But then what are the long-term brain responses to the fact that you've masked an underlying signal that is probably still there? If you turned it off, what would happen? And one of the things that could happen in response to it is because of brain plasticity, you could be changing neuroanatomy. hopefully in a positive way. And if you allow the brain to remap, right, to restore function, like people can restore functions after a stroke, even though you've killed areas of their brain, but with practice,
other areas do kind of take over.
Can take over, but it's really the connectome. You're changing the connectome.
Have you heard the story of the girl with half a brain?
The idea that they would remove half of it,
they don't take out half the brain stem.
Half the brain.
Yeah.
They might remove like a cerebral hemisphere in people who have like really, really, really bad cases of epilepsy.
Right. Yeah.
Kinds of stuff. And I know they've done it to like more than just a girl.
Yeah.
But it makes me think because there are some famous cases of epilepsy. Whether it's patient HM, who is one of the people who they discovered the difference between declarative and non-declarative memories and those kinds of things. Would they have even done those kinds of surgeries if deep brain stimulation was available back then? Could you, in a sense, neutralize? And epilepsy is one of the things that's actually been studied. Epilepsy happens because you have this abnormal excitatory activity in the brain that can spread. Right? So if you can neutralize some of that, like I said, if you have this abnormal activity and you put like a higher frequency thing that masks it, they probably wouldn't have done some of the drastic surgeries they used to do for people who had epilepsy if they had deep brain stimulation. You know what I mean? Because the global brain deficits could be a lot less.
Right.
And allowing people to sort of function in the world, which would be sort of cool.
Yeah. It's what about with memory? Does it, like, for example, is this used for Alzheimer's? Deep brain stimulation. Has there been research on that?
I think there's like phase 3 trials going on.
Okay.
But it's not, I wouldn't by any means talking about standard of care. And like I said, gotcha. Alzheimer's disease is one of the problem because some of the circuits are dead. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So unless, and eventually Alzheimer's starts as a localized disease, but eventually it becomes a global brain disease where brains atrophy. Imagine you had somebody with, there's different kinds of Alzheimer's too, but imagine you had somebody with Alzheimer's disease, you put this electrode in, this process in their brain, but one of the things that happens in this long-term disease over decades, brains atrophy and they shrink. So the relative position of that electrode is going to change as the brains are shrinking, as you're losing brain tissue later stage diseases.
You know, you'd have to maybe move it around. In the brain.
But it's you can't.
You can't really do that, can you?
No, your brain is not like jello.
Yeah.
You know, there are very specific circuits and very specific nuclei. So in a sense, yeah, that would not be a good thing, right? To using it in somebody and thinking, oh my God, this is, you know.
No, now it's causing problems.
Yes, because it's. Yeah, it would be. But epilepsy, I think, would be a great potential for it. Somebody with some of the affective disorders, whether it's major depression, Tourette's.
Like I said, the one person I saw worked very well with Tourette's in this.
Yeah, and the idea is if you have somebody with an abnormally functioning brain but intact brain anatomy that you might be able to overcome with electrical currents, that's wonderful. Exactly what the electrical currents are doing or how they're creating some of these improvements, people are still trying to figure out. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
What do you got? Makes sense to you?
Makes sense to me.
Okay, Dan, it's a good place to conclude the today's sort of conversation on your topic.
I think so. I think it's great. I learned a lot.
Did I not answer any of your questions?
I think you answered all my questions
in
my
babble.
Because now I know about the basal ganglia and the subthalamic nucleus.
Which is part of the basal ganglia. And I expect to see you in neurobiology next semester.
I hope. That
would
be fun.
Yeah, it would be. Okay, this is 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. We're recording live from the Digital Bronx Studios. Thank you for listening to Health 411. This program is part of Capital Health and Rider University's efforts to bring people together to address issues associated with all aspects of health and healthcare. I hope today's conversation has helped inform you about deep brain stimulation and maybe given you some more things to think about that you can go look up. If you have questions and or comments about this program or want to make suggestions for future broadcasts, please email us at health411@rider.edu.
Remember, you have a doctor's appointment scheduled for every Sunday at 10 a.m. Don't miss the all-new Health 411 with Dr. Jonathan Karp and our expert medical guest from Capital Health. You can listen to Health 411 anytime on demand. Go to 107.7thebronx.com/health411 to listen to past episodes or tune in every Thursday at 9
9 a.m. to hear the weekend rewind edition of Health 411. Health 411 on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.